begin by telling us about the Dharma Fund and what your vision is for it at the moment?
Yes, sure. So Future Dharma Fund, I co-founded 3 years ago, towards the end of 2015, although we actually launched 2016. And it came about because, well, I think I see, actually, how much the world needs the Dharma, how much Sri Ratna has got to offer, but how often it's not offered because of lack of money. That enthusiasm and that faith and that drive that people have to pass on the Dharma can't happen because of money. And I come from a sort of money background because I worked in finance, and I came into a context where a lot of people have never had anything to do with money, and so they would think that 2,000 was an irreconcilable, you know, a sort of insurmountable barrier to get $2,000 together, or $5,000 together. And I would say, but hold on, that's a tiny sum of money. Why is that getting in the way? So I thought, we need a bolder attitude to giving, and we need a fund that will make that happen. And I thought I'd like to put my time and my energy into raising that money. And so together with some friends, especially a guy called Nan Devadro, we started Future Dharma Fund. He's now the director of the fund, and I'm the fundraiser.
Oh, great!
Yes, what we do is we, in a way, we're finding out what we do as time goes on, because we can't just do everything to do with the Dharma or everything to do with Sri Ratna. So I think we're sort of in a way focusing in on seeding new sanghas and strengthening existing sanghas all around the world. So whether it's seeding a new sangha in Warsaw, in Poland, or in Moscow, or whether it's strengthening existing sanghas like this one here in Auckland, that's what we're doing.
Strengthening them in what way?
Yeah, to give a couple of examples here, we've got a project called the Seeker Project, which is training Dharma teachers. So several of your Dharmacharis and Dharmachunis in New Zealand, including Vasudhara, who's here, of course, in Auckland, have been doing online training in how to lead study groups with a guy called Ratnaguna, who's the real expert on that. I mean, he's been known for that for decades. He lives in the UK, so, of course, what to do? Well, he's done it online, yeah. So he ran it, two courses. There was so much demand in Australia and New Zealand, he was only going to run one course, but he ran two courses. They had 20 people, 20 order members wanting to do this course. So, several Dharmacharis, Dharmacharinis in here in New Zealand have completed that course. That'd be one example. Dharma Kumara is the new youth and young Buddhist coordinator for Australia and New Zealand. That came out of a realisation that at an order gathering, actually, about 3 years ago, that there was almost nobody under 50, and very few even under, or certainly almost nobody under 50, not that many, under 60, I don't think. And they thought, wow, if we don't do something, this order in Australia and New Zealand is just going to disappear in 20 years. There'll be no one left. So they realised, right, we've got to do something to make Sri Ratna and the Dharma more attractive to younger people. So Dharma Kumara is the result of that wish, and Future Dharma donors are making that happen. So those would be a couple of examples of strengthening the Auckland Sangha so that it's reaching young people, so that its study groups are even more vital. Even the materials that you use here in your study groups, like from Free Buddhist Audio and Buddhist Centre Online, so the Mitra study materials, we're the biggest supporter of Buddhist Centre Online. So we strengthen sanghas in that way. As well. I mean, there's quite a few ways, but ordination training, anyway, lots of things. So in a way, almost the problem I've got is how to talk about Future Dharma, because we've got 36 projects already in just 3 years.
Wow.
And so which ones do I choose to talk about? That's one of my challenges. But there are three examples for you, of how we strengthen sanghas.
Yeah, and so that's about expanding the sangha, so there's more capacity to generate more projects and
particularly seeding sanghas is. I mean, when we talk about seeding sanghas, that's often supporting one or two sort of really heroic individuals who are willing to move to another country, learn a new language, start classes. You know, all basically often it is on their own. I mean, the guy in Moscow, Sivanovir, is on his own.
Wow.
And he's had to do all those things Yeah, on his own, with some help from us. But the help from us is quite simple. It's just giving him some money so that he can come back to England for order retreats or order gatherings to kind of recharge himself. Also to fund other order members to go out on visits, because I think part of what we are in Sri Lanka, in fact maybe the main part of what we are, is we've talked about this in terms of a network of friendships, and that those friendships need to be manifest in a Dharma class so that people who come along see that, they see that quality of friendship, and they're attracted to that, which is impossible if you've just got one person on their own. So that's why we've also funded order members to fly out, in that case to Moscow, to work with Simona Vera for periods, short periods. Yeah. We're doing the same in Brazil and in India and other, Estonia, other places around the world.
Oh, right, yeah.
And Australia, actually, as well. There's a Maitri Pala is funded out there to be a kind of Kalyanamitra, kind of spiritual friend to the different centres in Australia.
Wow, so that's a lot of strong networking here.
Yes, right,
yeah.
So yeah, that definitely is all part of the effort to take the Dharma out to the world. So in a way, both of them, seeding sanghas, new ones, and also strengthening sanghas. I mean, although we've got 200 centres and groups around the world, and although that's reaching a lot of people, I reckon it's reached about 2 million people over our first 50 years. Still, it's huge. I mean, obviously, there's 7 billion people in the world. Most of them don't have access to a living sangha, a living spiritual community. I mean, plenty of those 7 billion have no interest, but quite a lot of them do have interest and would have interest if it was just offered to them. So I think that's a living out of our bodhisattva ideal when we do that. So yeah, that's a big part of our work, is starting new sanghas around the world, as well as strengthening existing ones, like, as I say, like yours here in Auckland.
And what are some of the challenges faced by the Dharma Fund?
Well, in a way, there's always a challenge with fundraising, of course. You know, once you take on these commitments, I say, well, those 36 projects, that's about, in New Zealand terms, about $500,000 a year. So, and up until recently, that was just me doing the fundraising. So that's a challenge, is just to find $500,000 a year from a movement where there's no rich people. I mean, generally, we don't have rich people, and anyone who's involved in Sri Lanka, if they're in a high-pressure, high-paid job, they often leave it fairly soon, which is what I did, actually, years ago. So yeah, that's the big challenge. It's just a challenge of fundraising. How do you find $500,000 a year? Related to that is, of course, the challenge that, how do I find it? Well, I need to come to centres like yours and meet people. But then, of course, centres themselves have their own fundraising challenges. I'd say one challenge is, in a way, persuading chairs of centres that it would be a good thing for fundraising for future Dharma to take place in their centre, because of course they're thinking, oh, but we need to fundraise for our local costs. So probably that's my biggest challenge, is how to communicate that, that in a way our wider international needs are also important, maybe even just as important. Without a wider Sri Lanka community, there is no Wellington Buddhist Centre, Auckland Buddhist Centre. Just been in Wellington last week, or earlier this week. So so without the wider Sri Lanka, there is no Auckland Buddhist Centre. So we need to support each other. That's the biggest challenge, is how to find those people and get access to those people who are going to together give $500,000 a year, and hopefully that will grow. I mean, at the moment it's about 350 people doing that. It's still quite a small number of people compared to a movement that must be, well, tens of thousands of people around the world.
Yeah. And what about, I mean, because, you know, with the likes of Windhorse, I mean, that was set up as a business to generate capital.
Yeah.
So what about that approach of actually setting up businesses or ventures to generate capital instead of...
Oh, yeah. I mean, Windhorse evolution was fantastic. I mean, Adistana, where I live... in England, was funded ultimately with money from Windhorse Evolution Shops, loads of outreach to the Berlin Buddhist Centre, the Krakow Buddhist Centre in Poland were funded with profits from that business. In a way, the close of that business 5 years ago is what necessitated the founding of Future Dharma Fund, because suddenly we didn't have those hundreds of thousands coming in every year in profit. But I do take your point. I don't think the only answer is fundraising. It would be great if a new right livelihood developed that was also generating profit. And in fact, part of what we're doing is working together with what's left of Wintles Evolution. It's called Wintles Trust. And they still have about 8 or 10 properties in Cambridge from those days. Some are used as community, some are rented commercially.
Mm.
No mortgages on them. So they've got assets. The rent on those houses is helping to fund these projects. So actually anyone who's listening who did work for Wintles Evolution, their work is still helping spread the Dharma through Future Dharma Fund. But what I wanted to say is that what we're developing together is a kind of Buddhist bank that would invest money and training in new Buddhist entrepreneurs who wanted to start up the next Wintles Evolution. They're very, very keen to do that. And lots of people, even if they're not willing to give large sums of money, they could lend reasonably large sums of money, which could be used as start-up capital for those through this Buddhist bank.
That sounds like an excellent idea. So, finding new ways of... I like the idea of Buddhist entrepreneurs. Creating new projects. Maybe have an online equivalent of Amazon or something.
Oh, well, there's a thought. An ethical Amazon.
Amazon.
Paid some taxes. Anyway. that would be great. I think in a way, the issue at the moment isn't lack of money for new businesses. It's who are those entrepreneurs? Who wants to step up and start a Buddhist business? Ideally team-based, because that's when it really becomes a Dharma practice as well.
Yeah.
It could also be the simple... I'm listening to a guy in Melbourne who sets up co-working spaces. So it could just be a number of individual entrepreneurs who just share a co-working space. They meditate together, they eat lunch together, and they're working on their projects in the same space. It could be that could be a sort of 2018 version of team-based Rotary Head. But yeah, we just need the entrepreneurs to come forward. So if you're listening, come forward.
Now's the chance.
Now's the time. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And is there anything else that you'd like to finish with about what might be important to the movement? And
well, I think the great challenge that we probably all face as Western Buddhists is the challenge of individualism. The idea that we're in our culture that this is the main thing is me and my life, and that just extends to me and my Dharma life, my spiritual life, and that basically it's about me just pursuing that. I think what each of us gradually learn as we get more involved in Triyatna is that that Triyatna isn't a kind of service, kind of offering. A product, if you like, to like a meditation product to individuals. We're creating a community, and I think that's the main thing that Future Dharma wants to support is the creation of community. That's what's going to really transform ourselves and help us go beyond self clinging, which in a way individualism is an expression of self clinging, and also importantly, not only just help us but create something that helps more and more people. The more of us who put our time and energy and love and money too into the Auckland Buddhist Centre and all the other communities that we're building around the world, the more people's lives we will touch, and that will contribute to a change in the world, even a kind of contribute to a kind of higher evolution, you could say, of human minds, human attitudes, human values, which then of course that's what's really needed to change the world. It won't be a political change that changes the world, it will be a transformation of mind, individually and collectively, and we've got a part to play in that, but only if each of us steps forward and contributes, say, whether it's money, time, love, just our whole lives, then that can happen. We can be part of that.
And how do you think we can open our receptivity to that?
I'd say the main way is to step forward, to step into it. The big shift that I had in my life was, Dharma life, was when I was coming along just as a bit of a consumer once a week to the class on Monday night at London Buddhist Centre. And, I basically just wanted my bit of meditation, a little bit of Buddhism, not too much, the odd retreat, and get on with what I wanted to get on with.
Mm.
And it was a guy in my group who said, hey, I've found a space we can use down in Brixton, which at that time was a sort of fairly run-down area of London. not anymore, but we could run meditation classes there for people. And Mitra Bandhu, who was leading our study group, had agreed. He says he'll come and teach the class, so we just need to do the publicity, set it up. And I was reluctant, to be honest. I was like, oh God, I'm already doing this Monday night, I'm not sure I want to do it Tuesday night as well, and Brixton down in South London. And I just didn't. But anyway, I did it. That was the decisive shift in my life personally, my Dharma life. Suddenly I was meditating twice a week. I was giving the Dharma to others. It was a pinch to my pride, because there I am in my city suit trying to hand out leaflets for classes, and people won't even look at me, let alone take a leaflet. But actually, it changed me. So in terms of how do we create change, how do we create, in ourselves, I think we step forward.
Mm.
We have the courage of our convictions. If we feel moved by this, if we feel there's something special happening here in Sri Ratna, in the Auckland Centre, we move towards it and we give, even if we're a bit reluctant.
Mm.
Yeah. The best advice I've ever heard on giving was apparently Dada Rinpoche's advice, who was one of Sangharakshita's teachers, which was, if in doubt, give.
Mm.
And I'm very glad that this guy, Satchidasa, now an order member called Satchidasa, asked me to contribute in the Brixton Centre, and I'm very glad that despite my misgivings, I did give.
Yeah.
And because the benefit to me was enormous. And actually, that Brixton group is now its own Sangha. It's the Brixton Centre. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's hopefully benefited many people in the 20 years since.
Mm.
That's my advice. If in doubt, just give.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That's a wonderful note to finish on. Thank you.
Great.
Discussing the relationship, our relationship between money and self.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you'd be able to expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, this relationship to money and self. I think we want money because it makes us feel more secure and independent, that we can handle whatever comes up. It's been talked about as abstract happiness. That's David Loy's phrase. So we know we want to be happy. We don't quite know how we'll get it, but we feel that money will make that possible somehow. And particularly we like it because, we'll feel independent. In fact, this is something a term we get, independently wealthy, not dependent on anyone else, not dependent on a job, not dependent on other people. And that's quite an attractive goal to most of us, maybe especially, as I mentioned earlier, in these quite individualistic times. It wouldn't have occurred in previous times. There's no way you could be independent if you're a member of a tribe or a village or a family. You depended on each other, and that's still the case in some more traditional societies, like in India, where I've spent a lot of time. But we like the idea of independence, but the catch is that when we become independent, the downside of being independent is that when we feel disconnected, we feel alienated from others, we feel lonely. I'm really shocked that the suicide rate so high in New Zealand, which is such a beautiful country and such a comfortable, materially comfortable country. I don't know if that's what's going on. I don't know if people are feeling so isolated almost by that material independence. I don't know. That's probably too simple a connection to make. I'm sure there's lots of factors at work. But I do know that the sense of isolation and loneliness is a real issue in the West, generally, certainly in the UK. And I wonder if that's partly sort of undesired fruit of, in a way, financial independence. We don't need other people. We can have things on our own terms. And actually doesn't make us happy.
Yeah. That is the great irony of it, isn't it? Mm. It's the catch. And so how do we loosen that?
Well, yeah. You'd be going against your wishes, wouldn't you? Because we have choice, we have the freedom.
Mm.
I mean, the way I'm trying to work against it, I must sound like a sort of, I've only got one message, but is through giving. That's the way I think that one can feel connected to others, because to give to somebody else, you have to be aware of that other person, you have to know what they need, and you have to overcome self-clinging to give. You have to overcome the thing that is the very cause of suffering, according to the Buddha.
Mm.
So I think although it's a very foundational practice. I mean, you don't need to be a Buddhist to think that giving is a good thing. It's basic human virtue, really. But it's also quite profound, because you're going directly against self-interest. You're going directly against the thing that causes us suffering, grasping, self-clinging. So that's my kind of practice of trying to go against self-clinging, is trying to be more generous. And the great thing about that is there's opportunities all day long to be generous. And you don't need, it doesn't even have to be money, it can be anything, although money's a good one because we're so attached to it, but it could be anything, as we know. And every moment of the day, every opportunity in the day where there's a chance to give, one can look within with awareness at that yes-no conflict that's almost always there. It's rare that we just think yes and we just do it. Usually there's a yes, and then there's quite quickly a, oh, but I'm not sure I've really got time, or, oh, God, I can't afford it, or, oh, I don't even like him very much. You know, that'll come in quite quickly. And that, I would say, is often our small self. It's the bigger self that says yes, and then the small self comes in with a no. And so every time that happens, there's a chance to work with our minds and become a bigger self several times a day.
Yeah, wonderful. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah.
My pleasure.